how do you become radio's best friend? Good news, you already are. Listeners like you keep us company through the busy days and late nights, sharing songs, moments, and memories. I'm Aiden, and during this year's Fun Drive, we're asking our best friends, that's you, to show their support by making a donation now at cjsffundrive.ca or by texting donate to 778-782-2573.
Today on Wings, feminist archivist and historian Max Dashew tells some of what she has uncovered and collected for her 16-volume series, The Secret History of the Witches.
The basic point of unity is patriarchal repression of female cultural expression, female spiritual leadership, and culture making.
There's a river of birds in migration. A nation of women with wings.
There's Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Max Dashew has spent over 50 years collecting and researching oral traditions, folklore, written records, and artifacts to find the women in history. She created the Suppressed Histories Archives to showcase her findings. Part of that is her 16-volume series, The Secret History of the Witches. In today's program, part one of two, Max Dashew speaks with Wings contributing producer Mindy Ran about the legacy of political abuse and violence hidden in the secret history of the witches. Most histories of witches tend to start with the European witch hunts. Mindy asked Max to tell how far back she has documented history of witches.
We can't look and say, oh, the witch hunts just started at the period of the witch craze. We have to look at the run-up, and it's a long development of many overlays of patriarchal repression. Actually, I did find record of witch hunts in ancient Greece and Rome, not in the same form, but they were persecutions of women as witches. Very often, you'll find is a lot of the scholarly treatments want to begin after the Middle Ages. And it's true that there was the old mythology was that witch hunts happened in the Middle Ages. And that was overthrown because it's true that the witch hunting terror started with the Renaissance and grew through the Baroque period in the height of it in the 1600s. However, the whole background of how these theologies and these ideologies arose, it's a much longer story. And there were documents that there were, in fact, witch burnings and witch persecutions in the period after 700, you know, up to like, I documented up to about 1100. And then there's the whole story about the overthrow of pagan societies, the development of state religion, Christianity, and the repressions that accompanied that. So you have to track that story and the ways that the bishops and canon law basically persecuted and outlawed old indigenous European forms of basically earth spirituality, you know, the veneration of trees and rocks and stones, or circle dances around bonfires and the singing of songs to deities that are now outlawed. All of that goes into the mix. So we need to know all of that because the ideologies develop in an earlier struggle to suppress old ethnic religious traditions among the common people. There's a lot of problems about the framing of this, such as fertility idols, which is very narrowing, you know, and then the sexualization of the framing of Venus figurines, which originates with a French aristocrat. One of the first Paleolithic icons, these little figurines, was found on his land, and he called her a shameless Venus because she was naked. It's an idea generated by the male gaze or patriarchal gaze.
How does that relate to the history of witches?
It relates in that anything having to do with the sacrality of women has been suppressed. And so a lot of the ceremonies of the witches centering around goddesses under various folk ethnic names was under fire at that point in time. They were making female figurines sometimes out of flax or other substances. They're not quite like the figurines that we have in the Neolithic. And even in later periods. It's more of a thematic connection than a direct connection. But the basic point of unity is patriarchal repression of female cultural expression, female spiritual leadership, and culture making.
So that's the thread that comes all the way through to now.
Yeah. When I first started this research, I just thought, well, you know, there's the pagans being repressed by the Christians, but Greco-Roman paganism itself was deeply patriarchal. The difference was that they did have priestesses, they did have goddesses and female spheres of power that still existed, even though those were very male-dominated societies. And we see the same thing happening in Europe in the early Middle Ages. They aren't matriarchies, but they do retain female leadership of women who, you know, under various titles in the ethnic cultures are called witches or seers or dreamers or healers. So it's important to track what kind of testimony we can get out of the folk cultures, because most of this was not recorded. But even just following that linguistic train, we can see a body of evidence that, in fact, these women were respected and seen as leaders. This is the complexity of history, because people tend to hew to a narrative of it's matriarchy, it's patriarchy. What I'm looking at is much more complex interplay of layers going on. And there's a way in which the common women were dominated socially in early medieval Europe by fathers and husbands. There was female infanticide. There was a lot of bad things going on. Yet, unlike 500 years after that, there were still very recognized cultural categories of women who were referred to as authorities, whether that be as healers or knowers, you know, diviners. And so this is the paradox of the witches, is that even just the concept of what witch became, how witch got defined as this negative thing, was because they were women of power who had, at least in that early period, social recognition for it. So it's a complex study. You can't really just make it all one thing or the other.
How were witches seen and defined at that stage?
Well, you know, a lot depends on by who. We have the folk names that reflect knowers, seers, dreamers, wise women, healers. And that was recognized even by their opponents in the clergy and in men in state positions, including the feudal lordship. You know, those men saw that they were powerful and they feared that power and they tried to repress it. But there was this idea that they had this power. And so you have in the witch trials in Germany in the 15, 1600s, sometimes they would pick the woman up and carry her into the courtroom because they were afraid if her feet were in contact with the earth that she would draw power from it and thereby overcome them. But, you know, it really depends who is looking at them. And there is this concerted effort to redefine that which is seen as positive by the common people. As late as the 1300s, you've got various preachers and theologians trying to convince people, don't go to the witch. Yes, she will cure you, but it's with the devil's power. And so they recognize that among the common people, there was a consensus that these women were really doing something of value, not harming people, but they were still determined to define it as negative.
Why were they so terrified of women?
The fear is there, but it's also more than fear. They're afraid of their power being overthrown. They want to dominate. And in order to do so, they have to repress any powerful woman that could be a threat to that domination. So, you know, really, if they were so afraid, then you would think they would not go around attacking women, because it wasn't only just burning at the stake. There were groups of men going around beating up women, you know, in the villages that they believed were witches that had caused their animal to be sick or whatever the thing that went wrong was. And so they weren't afraid of them in that sense, but they were, there's a scapegoating mechanism that went on. And, you know, we can see that even now with people who are afraid and they buy into these overarching conspiracy narratives. Somebody outside over there elsewhere is conspiring to do terrible things to harm society. And, you know, in a way, the witch hunts laid the ground for a lot of the persecutory dynamics that we're seeing being played out now. But at that time, women were an easy target. It wasn't that they were so powerful that nothing could be done to them. it was easy to attack women and to blame women.
That has very neatly brought us up to the church, the European witch hunts. What do we need to know that is different from what we are usually told about the European witch hunts and what was happening in terms of church and state? Because your research, I think, clearly shows there is a lot we don't know and that would change our perspective.
So, look, you know, the stereotype is that the church committed the witch hunts. And the church did do witch hunts. Certainly the Inquisition was, you know, a major engine in driving this and actually spreading it. And the Pope in the early 1200s, mid-1200s, authorized the use of judicial torture, which really just vastly exploded the persecution. And the church also laid the ideology, and going back to this devil worship meme, the idea that witches harmed people and did so with diabolical power. All of that we have to lay at the door of the church. But as time went on, the state had always been involved. The early anti-witch laws, the witch hunting laws, were made by kings and lords. And so there was always a state repression in view as well, again, under influence of the church to a large degree. But in the mass witch hunts, the biggest persecutions were not necessarily carried out by the church, but by the state. And this is a piece that people usually miss. And so, you know, again, it's convoluted because the church definitely shaped this whole narrative and drove it. It's ironic, though, that like in Italy and Spain, with the Inquisitions that were going on there, they began drawing back. Having created the problem, they then began to put it up to peasant superstition and to start to quash it. But the blaze was already out of control, and they couldn't. What they had wrought, you know, and there was popular opposition to this. There were peasant revolts in Italy in the early 1500s against the witch hunts that were then ravaging the northern Alpine regions. So there's a lot there, but that's a stereotype, I think, that's important. The other, of course, is the witch as evildoer. And, you know, Joan Scott said about the Renaissance, you know, this glorified Renaissance we've all learned about. Did women have a Renaissance? Because this was the period where the witch hunts really began to accelerate. So it was a very different picture from the standpoint of women. The Enlightenment is a little bit later than the Renaissance. Basically, a lot of the patriarchal forms that had been created by the church were kept intact. The Enlightenment thinkers attacked church authority, but they kept intact the patriarchal order. So, you know, in the French Revolution, there was repression against feminist voices, and in the formation of the universities and the new scientific perspectives, you know, the idea of women's inferiority becomes a scientific principle rather than a theological one. And this is something that also had roots. The Greeks had also posited this. You have Hippocrates and his school of thought, you know, all of these ideas about the womb being this disease-producing organ. And the foundation of universities actually came out of the canon law schools of the church. And the canon lawyers were men. You had to be a male to be in those schools. So in a way, a lot of the patriarchy that was embedded in that continued along as the university system grew up out of it. And this is important to know because I think in our universities, women have always been on the back foot, came in on male sufferance, very often being harrowed and persecuted by hostile male students and professors. And in order to exist in that sphere, really had to adhere to a great degree to whatever the prevailing doctrines were to even be heard. So it's interesting to see how these long trajectories of foundational patriarchy get carried along, even in the midst of ideological changes such as happened during the Enlightenment.
A lot of what you're talking about, nothing's really changed here.
It morphs. The male domination and the racism, the colonial repression doesn't change. It only changes rationale.
On Wings, you are listening to feminist archivist and historian Max Dashew, talking to Wings producer Mindy Wran about the history of witches. They covered some of the salient insights from Dashew's 16-part series, The Secret History of the Witches. Next on this program, Max discusses some of the mechanisms behind the witch terror and the lasting legacy of witch hunts until today.
They finally saw that this was really cruel and unfair and horrifying. The idea of, you know, being incinerated in front of a mob of screaming people. And one thing that happened that is another complicating factor is that the persecution was driven by church and state, and the ideology of diabolism amped by torture really generated a lot of hysteria. Maybe that's the wrong word, but, you know, this frenzy that happened multiple times before the whole phenomenon finally ended. We could argue that it hasn't even fully ended in terms of socially. The legacies of it or the behaviors are still being acted out, although not with fire. Is that in the local witch hunts, there would be a terrible terror of, like, you know, that would go on for years. And then it would reach a certain point. It would start with a persecution of common women, you know, women without much property, old women very often. And then it would spread. And because of the torture, people didn't want to denounce their friends and family. So they would denounce other people that they didn't really know. And so gradually the accused would spread into the middle classes and to men. I mean, there were always men who were persecuted, but, you know, it was very much heavily against women. And there would be a shutoff valve that would click at a certain point when enough powerful men or rich men were being accused, or rich women for that matter, that people would go, oh, wait, no, this can't be true. Not Burgomeister so-and-so. And then it would stop. And it would stop for maybe 30 years. And then enough time had passed that it would start up again because it was still raging all around. And so you had these multiple stops and starts that happened. But, you know, I think one factor was that as the frenzy brought in people who are not the usual suspects, people were much more likely to be skeptical of it. And that helped to change more minds.
Were people under severe pressure to name someone?
Yeah, because they were tortured until they named someone. Technically, there was no torture in England, but they would use sleep deprivation and other severe conditions in the dungeons, including rape. It was torture under other names. They weren't using thumb screws or the rack or the strappado, but they were, you know, they were coercing quote unquote confessions. This is what really drives me crazy, is even in modern literature, you'll find scholars talking about she confessed as if she had done it. You know, it's taking the standpoint of the torturers and validating it. And it was all coerced. So that was just a huge engine driving all of this. And then here's another piece of it.
Who was coercing them? And how were people chosen to be coerced? What was the mechanisms?
You have the church and state. So in the case of the state, you have the prosecutor. Sometimes doctors would accuse people. You know, male professionals were very involved in driving this, which is another factor that many feminist scholars have noted, how the witch hunts coincide with men pushing women out of obstetrics gradually. And, you know, this basically take over of areas that had been under female jurisdiction, including healing to a large degree in medieval Europe. But you have a male officialdom of the state doing the persecutions. If it was in Catholic countries, then you have the Inquisition who would try people, and then they had a fiction that the church cringes at shedding blood. So they would hand the person over to the state to be executed. But, you know, they would quote unquote recommend mercy, but they actually would get angry. This happened in Venice. If the state refused to execute them, then the church would be furious and protest. Or in the cities, you've got the municipal authorities who would charge people, or you would even have state officials who would send out a call for denunciations of witches. But anybody who came in and accused somebody under the right circumstances, you know, as this thing gained steam, then officialdom was inclined to believe them. And they would have these big trials, you know, using torture. And then when she's on the scaffold and they're getting ready to, you know, to burn her at the stake, they would often offer her mercy if she would assent to the confession that had been read out, that was extracted under torture. And they would say, look, we will strangle you and you won't have to burn alive, but you have to tell the crowd that you did it. So this is one of many ways that it spread, because people said, well, you heard her, she confessed, and they don't really understand all of what's going on there, because who would rather not be strangled than to be burned alive? You know, so it's terror all the way through. And also the broadsides that were being published, this is kind of like the scandal sheet press, and people were avidly snapping up these broadsheets describing what supposedly happened, what this witch had supposedly done, and how she was tried, and all the gory details of it. And this was one of the major early uses of the printing press, because, you know, they were printing Bibles and things, but on the local level in the towns, there were these scandal sheets that were being published saying all the horrible things that the witch had done, having turned herself into a pig and ravaged through the gardens of this person and then killed these children before they were even, you know, able to walk, whatever the story was, right? Turning into animals, and then how the authorities tried them, and they would have woodcuts of the burnings. And people, sometimes they were advertisements for the burnings, and people would stream in mobs to watch the executions. This is like kind of like the Roman bread and circuses. There was like a spectacle of horror that got played out. And this was like a really severe corruption of the society. There was no room for compassion, much less justice, in such a setting.
Were people who denounced witches rewarded?
Yeah, sometimes. You have cases, too, of men that denounced women and said, well, I was there at the Sabbat, and I saw Lady so-and-so, whatever her name is, she was having sex with the devil, and she was doing these things, and they were rubbing baby fat on them for their flying ointments, whatever the wild stories were that they came up with. And he would not be prosecuted. He would become a state witness. But there were numerous examples of this in France and Switzerland and Italy, you know, the best documented. You have the witch hunters also in England, the witch finders like Matthew Hopkins. So there was a very avid class of male persecutors that were not in official positions, but they created these professions for themselves as witch hunters, witch prickers, you know, going around with bodkins and stabbing the women. And if there was an insensitive spot, or maybe the bodkin was made to retract so they weren't really being stabbed at that moment, that proved that she was a witch. And so then she would be hauled off to be hanged in the case of Britain. There's no real logic to it other than the authoritarian repression, the spectacle, the public celebration of misogyny, the demonization of a female other or any other kind of other. You know, there were disabled people. There were men, often foreigners or outsiders in some other way. You know, they could have been gay or gender variant. There's a whole lot of different other reasons for this. Some of the men who were accused were relatives of women who had been accused. So it was still related to the basic theme of misogyny.
I think that one point that sticks out that you were talking about was the male domination of birth.
That taking away of female professions. You know, doctors also competed with in France they were called Mireuse, the healers, both in the rural areas and also in the cities like Paris. And so there were state persecutions that were technically not witch hunts. They were more, oh, you violated this municipal statute and now we're going to fine you. And they would basically be designed to drive these women out of practice. So, you know, this is the other side of the witch hunts. It's not all executions. There's fines, and some women were exiled and thrown out of their hometown, or they were branded. And sometimes that branded woman, that made her a target. She would be accused again. So you have examples of women who were accused earlier in life who escaped. They did not actually get tried and executed. But as they got older, it was seen more likely a reputation of them as a witch had solidified. And then it was easier. And in many cases, they were tried later. And then they did fall to the persecution. There was in Britain scoring aboon the breath, which means to cut a woman in the upper part of her face above the breath. And they would attack her with a knife or a pin, and they would scratch at her face or wound her in order to draw blood to neutralize whatever spells she was accused of casting.
During the witch hunts?
Yeah. Even after, I mean, this was still going on in the 1800s in Scotland and Northern England. So it's just accepted that she's such a harm doer that, of course, it's a good thing. Of course, it's justified to physically assault her in that way, to gouge her face. And there were other cases of women who were lynched and beaten to death by a mob of men. And there are a group of trial records in France actually appeals to the crown to pardon these men, which was granted in nearly every case. And the crown assessor would say, by lack of good management or otherwise, she expired. So they're blaming the fact that they beat her to death on her, right? That she is assumed to be such a harm doer that she causes magically through her evil thoughts harm on some unidentified other person, that it's okay to physically punch her face or punch her in the throat. And you have imagery of lesbian feminists with crew cuts getting their face smashed in by a big gloved male fist, right? So I see a direct line here, because the dehumanization of these women, first as witches and now for turfcraft, is so pervasive, and many people are afraid to challenge it, because again, there's this climate of fear. If you defend witches, then you must be a witch. And that's really one of the operative codes undergirding this whole repression.
Witch hunts are not gone. That's a continuum.
It is. It definitely is. And you know, there are examples of this happening in Indian Nepal. Papua New Guinea has been very bad with this, you know, horrific torture executions by fire of women, always of women in that case. And we Tanzania, there have been some very horrific burnings, some parts of East Africa, the Ghana witch camps. And these a lot of times are older and widowed women. And mixed in with that, not really recognized universally as witch hunts, but widow persecution definitely ties in with that in some countries, because the accusation is that the man died because she somehow had performed sorcery that caused him to die. And there are rituals, I think, in Igbo country, where a woman has to drink water that the dead man has been washed in as an ordeal in order to prove that she did not kill him. You know, and then expropriation, they lose everything that they've built in their life up till that time in this patrilocal marriage, and they're thrown out because the family wants the house back. You know, she's no longer useful because she's no longer his wife. Witch hunting covers a whole range of persecutions. And I think that also here in the Anglophone world, we're living with the legacies of witch hunts, because accusing a woman is so easy. You know, accusing a woman for acts of speech is something we've seen being revived. And this idea that a woman, by some magical power, can from a remote distance harm someone, including someone she's never met. This meme is still very much active, that is being instrumentalized against women for feminist speech. I mean, when I began this research, I was already seeing the legacies of the witch hunts. But in the backlash since, you know, 1980, especially, we've seen an increased hostility to female dissent, you know, to feminists in general, I think. But, you know, the space for women to say what we feel, to define ourselves and our oppression, is under increased attack from the left now, as well as from the right.
Scared yet? Wait, there's more. Part 2 of Mindy Rand's interview with Max Dashew will focus on rebellion and reclamation. You can read about the secret history of the witches at www.suppressedhistories.net. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose online events can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.